Sheila Kohler is a South African writer now living in the United States. She is the author of 10 novels, including Cracks, which was adapted into a 2009 film of the same name, and first was published as a short story in the Paris Review, and that is the one we're talking about today. She's also the author of 3 short story collections. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, O Magazine, and was included in the Best American Short Stories. She has twice won the O. Henry Award. Welcome, Sheila Kohler.
It would behoove you to read the book, read the short story, try and watch the movie, because you'll enjoy our conversation more. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the genesis of the story.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it was a story that began, you know, as a shorter form, and then I worked on it and expanded it, and eventually it became a novel. So that was an interesting exercise, if you will. There are differences, though, of course, between the, and we'll probably talk about that, but it did start out as something shorter, and then
expanded. I did notice that, and I noticed a lot, something we didn't talk about last time, because everybody knows that I have told everyone that I messed up the recording, but actually now I get to ask you a question that I missed the first time. I mean, we talked about it sort of tangentially, but not really, we didn't really focus on it, which is the collective we, you know, that you tell the story from that perspective. And I'd love to hear about your decision to do that. Did that come in the beginning, or did you try different perspectives and then end up with the we?
As I remember it, I really started there because I felt, you know, and I feel that adolescence is the one time when one is really a group. So the we voice is very appropriate. And it also enabled me anyway in the story to recreate the kind of vocabulary. And I don't know why, but I'm somebody who has a very clear memory of adolescence and the way we spoke and the terms we used. So I was able to do that, you know, with words like boozy and Lizzie and cracks, the term cracks itself, which we used in boarding school at that age. So the we voice then gives you the group voice, but it also enables you to go into the heads of, you know, the members of the swimming team. So you can sort of do both. In some ways, you can be an omniscient narrator, but you can also give a particular time and place and sound to the voice. And then, of course, I had, you know, some models in mind. We may have mentioned that when we were talking about it. You know, Faulkner's A Rose for Emily, the tale is told by the group. And then there's Geoffrey Eugenides' wonderful Virgin Suicides, where it's a boys, group of boys who is telling the story about these 5 girls who commit suicide. Yes.
Yeah, there's kind of a mythic quality to it. And I was also thinking about the archetype of the girls, the different roles that they play in the story. You know, like Di is sort of the, I don't know, would you call her the queen bee?
That's good. That's
yeah. Good. Or like Fuzzy, you know, she struck me as sort of a scapegoat, not a scapegoat, but
the one with the imagination. And she's the one who has the voice, right? She can recite too. And
yes,
one of the teachers has her recite from Ozymandias, you know, look on my works, ye mighty in despair.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's Anne, and she's sort of the know-it-all. That's sort of great. The, yes. I guess when you think back to high school, when you think back to school in general, everybody had their roles that they played.
Right.
more than later in life.
Right. And maybe I, you know, exaggerated that a little bit, because on the page, I think you have to make things a little simpler, and particularly as there were 13 of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in order to keep them. Another thing I did actually, which is helpful, For a reader, I think, you know, so because when we read, we forget names, right? Was to give them nicknames, you know. So I did that, you know.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Yeah.
Reckless Radfield, I think she is, and Sweet Skeen, you know, with alliteration used so that we could remember the names of the girls on the team.
Yeah. And Di, so Di in particular, we didn't talk about much last time, but I was thinking, you know, that is, she's just a huge part of the story. And she, her father has committed suicide. And so now her, you know, her mouth turns down. And then she ends the story too.
Yes, yes. And she is the one who, both in the story and then in the novel, she does see Miss G with Fiamma, right? And so she's the captain of the team. She's the instigator. So her role is important all the way through. Yes.
Right. Life keeps sort of hitting her father, and then she's the one who sees Fiamma, and she's sort of the one who does everything first.
Could say that.
It hardens her. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about the descriptions. You mentioned in our last conversation that you actually went to a boarding school, and that was sort of the basis. You based it on that location.
Except that I exaggerated and perhaps a little, because I never actually say where we are. I remember having an interview actually with somebody from South Africa, and she was trying to think of the various schools in South Africa.
Oh, so she knew them all.
So I didn't want to actually, you know, name a school. But we were in an area where there were frequent droughts. And of course, this whole arid landscape adds to the story and gives us the emotions that are expressed, you know, concretely, if you will, with the expression of using the outside world to reflect what's going on within these girls. This area where they've been sent, you know, because they are very young. And this is, you know, a time where there were not schools in some of these parts of Africa that were, you know, very distant. And so these girls have come there, you know, taking trains, and some of them 5, 6 years old they were. And this was based on reality.
Wow.
They had these, you know, long train rides coming to a place where they were not going to see their parents for 6 months. So that's, again, accentuating both the group, the whole place. Everything sort of echoed off one another. Reading the book, I was sort of amazed that I had managed to do that. It's not that easy to do, where everything leads you to the final sentence.
Even the word, that internecine?
Yes.
Did that come later, or did that word just pop to mind? I'm just wondering about some of these things. You know, Fuzzy singing All Things Bright and Beautiful, and that word, and then some other things. Everything is a hint about what's coming.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, obviously when you write these things first, you discover things on the page. Anyway, that's the way I write. Because that's very boring if you knew exactly what was going to happen. So I didn't always know where I was going. But obviously when you look back on something, you can accentuate things that actually will foreshadow what you eventually discovered by the end of the work.
So you might have had them look up another word, but then when you went back and read through, you thought, well, what would be a better word? Maybe.
I was never really conscious of, you know, I think there's belligerent too, that she looks up at various words that, and of course was something that I did do. Each one of these girls, although they're very different, obviously has little bits and pieces of myself. That was something that I would do in the early morning. I would get up and I really was reading Winston Churchill at the words.
Who was it who said, if you survive childhood, you have enough material to last a lifetime? Was that? I don't know who it was, but it's a great line. It's so true. So we didn't, I have cracks written down here, the word, because we talked about it last time, but can you just tell me a little bit more about that?
Right. Yes, so it was a term, it was used, and it basically meant a crush. We were in a girls' boarding school. There were only girls around, and many of us had crushes on an older girl. And so we'd say, I'm cracked on so-and-so, and she's my crack. And it really was and I think I told the story about the film, that was made by Jordan Scott, and how it was chosen for the Toronto Film Festival, and how she was asked that question because she gave a talk where the film was showed. She answered some questions. She was interviewed. And they asked her, why did you call your film Cracks? And I thought, oh, good. Now that's the moment when Sheila Kola is going to come up.
Yes.
Mention me at all. And she just went into a long explanation of how the word conveyed, the symbol of fissures and cracks in the society, which,
I'm just sort of astonished by that because, I mean, that seems so unfair. So you had no, were you on the set at all when they filmed the movie or?
No, not at all. Not at all. I was, as I tell people, unless you're very famous, perhaps, but otherwise you're not a very important personage. They did give me a seat, when I wrote to them, and because I'd seen it on Google that the film had been chosen at the Toronto Film Festival. So I wrote and they said, oh, yes, we'd love you to come. But nobody, gave me a ticket.
Nobody asked, but nobody wrote to you along the way and said, what is cracks mean? What is And then the film takes place, hopefully some people have had time to see it, in England rather than in South Africa. And there were moments that it was a little bit jarring because they're very hot in the film. And they're swimming so much, which you would only be able to swim really in the summer, right, toward the end of the year or maybe in the beginning of the year. Could you swim most of the school year or?
Certainly 9 months, because the summers are much longer, and the winters are short. So the winters we didn't swim. That was like 3 months, but it was very short. Obviously with this drought that I accentuated, accentuating the increasing heat, which enabled me with the novel to increase the tension. And the teachers get rather lax, there's too much drinking going on in the teacher's room. And so the whole, there is a crescendo effect, if you will, which I obviously stressed when I was rewriting the book.
I mean, I assume there was no air conditioning or limited air conditioning. No air conditioning.
Air conditioning, no heat.
Oh my gosh.
Planes in the winter too, where we would say, oh, this is worse than Jane Eyre. I think I used that in the in the book because we had read Jane Eyre, and it's very cold, really cold. So we would say, oh, it's worse than, which it wasn't, of course, but
Yeah, it gets you after a while. Okay, well, right away we get a hint that Miss G is a rebel. She smokes cigarettes and holds them under her hand so Miss Nevin, the headmistress, can't see. We learn that the girls make themselves faint in part because they want Miss G to rescue them. When you were creating her, I think you said when we talked before that she was sort of an amalgam of different teachers, but she is obviously exaggerated. Can you tell me what you were conceiving when you conceived the character Miss G?
Yes, well, she is definitely
an exaggeration.
Just that I had. And one, of course, was this woman who was actually a Belgian and who called herself the Principessa Colonna, which I don't think she had the right to. She may have been married to one of the younger sons and that. She had like a finishing school actually in Florence. And I spent some time there because my sister was there too. And so I was sent over to join her. And this woman, I don't know what she'd been reading, but she probably Freud or Jung or something, because she said, I want no repression here, girls. I want you to speak frankly of your desires. And you know, we sort of looked at one another. Plus the fact that she gave us, for our meals, she would mix, and I've never seen anybody do this. She would mix the red and the white wine. She had these big vats of wine and she would mix them in our glasses.
Never heard of that.
We weren't used to drinking wine with our meals in the first place, but this kind of mixture was quite lethal. So she would say, speak of your desires. And then she would give us, you know, these details about boys and what happened to them and with the girls and the things that we absolutely had no idea about. So she was in there a little bit. It's interesting how we create these characters. But there was a writing teacher who was very important because the basic metaphor of swimming, I realized I was using to actually talk about writing. And I had studied with various writing teachers, and we will remain nameless. That was also part of our writing instruction, that you address the dark parts of your life, right? That you are fearless, that you will say anything. If you want to do it, well, and if you want to do it enough, you know, no holes barred. And I think that actually is good advice to a writer. You've got to go into those places which you would normally not do in polite conversation.
Mm-hmm. It is good advice. It is. And it's hard to get there. But when back to that teacher, the Belgian teacher, she, you know, today we would say, was that grooming? And I was wondering, you know, when you were talking about the word cracks, So my understanding is that you would have a crack on some, but it was very innocent at that time.
The plot, obviously, of the book was made up.
Mm-hmm.
And there it's my dark mind coming out, if you will. But these things, well, there were some, you know, sometimes the girls would comfort one another at night in the bed. That happened. Although not a lot, I don't think, but some of that did go on.
But that's just normal kid stuff. And the teacher had done that today. We would recognize that this was not normal behavior, but apparently no one was watching.
No, yes, that's the thing. And now, of course, I do a lot of teaching, and I think the pendulum has swung the other way.
Yeah.
So careful about what we say that it sometimes hinders our teaching. But because now, of course, one's so conscious of all these things, and, you know, we pass these tests beforehand to make sure that we're conscious of what we're saying and what we're doing and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I was wondering, so I was fascinated, I mentioned this before, the RCs, how people thought of Roman Catholics. And I think it's so valuable to remember that and to have that in a story so that we all know, like, this was very recent, this kind of discrimination and wariness of a group of people. But I bet it would be hard to get that in a story right now because they would say, oh, you can't do that. But it's reality. It's not the writer creating this. It's the writer just presenting what they've seen.
Right. And also making people aware of the fact, too, I think, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
These things that are not said at one point, that's not good either. You want to bring them out into the air, and the writer certainly does that. Yet this kind of hostility between Protestant and Catholic, that's, you know, sort of been forgotten in some way because other things are on our mind at the moment.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But it's sort of a valuable lesson. So last time we did talk about Treasure Island, the mentioning of the black spot and the fact that you have the graves of Sir George Harrow and his bull terrier Jock. And they were sort of features, or they were based on features of the actual school that you attended.
Yes. So, and I, the basic structure of both the story in a way and the novel, the basic structure of the story is what happened to Fiamma.
Right.
Question that you need at the beginning of a story.
Mm-hmm.
Did she really faint or did she pretend to faint? And that's the question, right? And if she did faint, if she did really faint, why was it? And so the girls come up with the various answers. And of course, this is the advantage of being in the heads of these young adolescents. And of course, they come up with ridiculous suggestions, really. And the one actually says, well, you know, maybe she was pregnant, what they call preggy.
Yeah.
You know, how could she be pregnant? And Anne Lent, who is a little bit more rational, says, well, who would be the father?
You know? Right. There's no one around.
Maybe you could do it to yourself. You know? Oh, in the novel, I think they say maybe two girls could do this to themselves. That they could.
Yes, in the novel, but not in the story. Yes.
And one of the things that somebody suggests is that maybe somebody gave her the black spot, which of course comes out of Treasure Island. And then somebody else says, but she wouldn't have probably read that in Italy, because Fiamma, of course, is Italian. And so we get the whole thing about giving somebody the black spot, which means you're going to kill them.
Wow, and yeah.
Ultimately, what happens in the novel, not to give too much away, because I'm hoping...
Well, I'm hoping they've read it, but if they haven't, they should, because it's fascinating, too, to think about the structure of the novel as opposed to the short story, because the novel... there's more of a retrospective feeling to it. They come back. Yeah, they're back for the reunion. And then it's sort of the second part begins with where the short story starts. Is that like, first we get the reunion and then we go back.
Girls come back to school. So you have the element of memory. Mm-hmm. They're there in the present. And whereas the story is told in the present, in the sense that it's all in one day, right? Fiamma fainted in chapel this morning. So it's this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is contained by this day and what happened to Fiamma.
Right.
Whereas the novel, you have this reunion, these girls coming back 40 years later. They're coming back to school because they need money. The school needs money. So they've dragged them forth with a little threat in the letter. And so you have this much more time between what's going on in the present, which is this reunion, and you also discover what's happened to these girls in the novel. What have they become? What have their lives been? And then you discover, you know, Fiamma is not there. What has happened to Fiamma?
Mm-hmm.
So the main question there too. Yes.
So did you, it must have been fascinating to be able to write it in, you know, with the immediacy of the short story, only sort of revealing what they would know at the time, right? So it's so immediate. They only know as much as they know. And then later to be able to play it out over all the years and what they've learned since. And what did you learn from each version? Did you enjoy one more than the other, or?
No, not really. I think I enjoyed to some extent, although the novel obviously took much longer and, you know, was rewritten many times. And the short story, well, the short story I worked on too, but perhaps for not quite so long. And after all, the short story is easier in the sense that you do only have this one time sequence, you know, it's one day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to bring in quite as much of the development of the lives of the protagonists. So the characters can be more developed too, which makes it more interesting too. You can have scenes, as I said, initially with the wee voice too, you can split them off. And there's a scene where Meg Donovan, who is a very pretty girl and good and kind, and the younger girls like her a lot, she is invited to tea, right? Because she goes, they're allowed out. Mostly it's enclosed within the school, you know, so there's this feeling of closure where they can't get out. But there are these few escapes. And one is that they're allowed on a Friday to go to town if they have to go see a doctor or something. And Miss G takes Meg out to tea and sort of puts her hand on Meg's knee. And Meg is telling the girls, because then she comes back and tells the girls. So there are scenes like this that I could do that were not directly connected with the ending of the book, but add to what you know, this building the characters, the development of the characters.
Tell me about the inclusion of the character Sheila Kohler in the short story.
Yes, she's there in both. Yes, and that's, you know, for verisimilitude, I felt that it makes you feel that story must be true if you're using the author's name, right? But of course, she's just a character too. Although I, of course, did use parts of my life, as I did with all these characters to some extent. But Sheila Kohler does do some bad things that she confesses to. One is swimming and in a race and pretending to faint, you know. Just
yeah, because she couldn't go on. So she's just like, forget it, I'm going to sink. It struck me that the inclusion of Sheila Kohler, you know, we all, especially anyone who maybe suffered some neglect or was in a tough position, became sort of like a bully. I mean, I know I had my moments, and I thought it's very cathartic to write yourself into the story and then say, you know, and I was also a part of something that maybe wasn't that great. Okay, I have a memoir fiction question, but I'm going to stick to the story for a second and make sure I've covered everything. Oh, I loved the part just before we leave the Sheila Kohler character. I didn't mention this last time, but I love this line. Sheila Kohler cried afterward. She said she had told the minister she had read banned books, but she was not sorry because they told the truth. Anne Lindt said Sheila Kohler was just trying to get Miss G's attention. And I thought, oh, that's so perfect. It resonates so much today. All right, we haven't talked about Fiamma, and I want to talk about her and your creation of that character, also about the painting in Fiamma's house, and the fact that in the novel, rather than the short story, we don't really know what she thinks of Miss G. Fiamma's more of a mysterious character in the short story than she is in the novel. We get even more about her reaction. So I'm just curious about the creation of that character and the inclusion of that painting to start.
Yeah, well, Fiamma is the foreigner, right? The stranger. And I suppose we all feel a little bit, particularly writers, I think, that we feel we don't quite belong, right, wherever we are. And that's why we, in a way, that gives us the distance to be able to write about it. Mm. So Fiamma comes from a different background. She supposedly has, you know, been very privileged and lived in this grand house and comes from a different culture. You know, her references, and she's rather bored in school and falls asleep much of the time, but she knows a lot that the girls don't know. You know, she knows about Mazzini, and she knows, you know, about Italian literature, Dante. She can quote the beginning of the Inferno. And so the girls don't really understand her. And they're both very jealous of her. She's very beautiful too. You know, she looks like the way she walks, and then the fact that Miss G, who they all have a crush on, should be taken with her. She's this really good swimmer. Mm-hmm. So there's elements of jealousy that I think are very important, unfortunately, in our lives, and particularly amongst writers, I think it can happen.
It's true, yes.
Because some, you know, there's just so much success that can be passed around in a field like that. So I wanted to concentrate a little bit on that, I think, and how this jealousy grows with Miss G's absolute. And this comes a little bit from this writing teacher that I happen to have worked with, who would have, you know, favorites. You know, somebody he would say, oh, you're better than James Joyce. And of course, you know, and then the next time, oh, no, you're no good at all.
Right. So you're living for those moments and they can be withdrawn. You're in such a vulnerable place.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I was, you know, trying to write about that, about ambition, you know, people trying, and the teacher who says, all you have to do is desire it. Just, you know, just go for it.
But of course that isn't true, right? It's not true. You can desire a lot of things and they never happen. Oh, it's so unfair. It's so unfair.
Happened that you didn't sometimes even ask for.
Right.
That's life, because there is chance, right?
And there's talent, there's innate talent. There's differences. There are differences between people, and right. And you just feel at that age, if the collective can gang up on someone and take them out. Back to the fainting really quickly. That was something that we did growing up too, where someone would make you faint. They'd like hold your neck a certain way and you'd hold your breath and then you'd faint. But I had never heard of someone making themselves faint. How did they do that exactly?
Oh, we did it. We did it just, you know, each person did it by themselves, just holding their breath. And the girls at school did do that. And I talked to my granddaughter about this, and she said they did it too. She went to an English school and she said they did that too. You know, you hadn't had breakfast, the chapel, on your knees, you're on your knees for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then hold your breath.
I guess the question, so they switched in the movie, it switched to an English location. Were some other things in the movie, because I got a different feeling from Miss G in the book, in the movie, in the short story. I mean, in the short story, we don't really know, you know, we're left with that mystery of what happens. And we're left in the last scene between Miss G and Fiamma. Does, you know, Fiamma has her back to her. So is she surprised when Miss G comes up behind her? Did she know she's going to do that? We don't have any idea. Does she want that to happen? But then as you started expanding that in the novel, and then I guess they took it in their own direction in the movie, how did you come about? I mean, I wondered what the process was of really delving into that situation.
When I wrote it, I initially had a much tamer scene at the end. And I think I have a wonderful reader who happens to be my eldest daughter. Mm-hmm. And she read it and she said to me, "Mummy, if you're going to do this, go for it."
Wow. Yeah. Oh, and are we talking about this in the short story?
No, this was in the novel.
In the novel,
and the girls really, you know, get into what happens to Fiamma at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the movie, for some reason, they make Miss G responsible, right? It's two, I think, but my concern was with these girls. So I wanted to stay with the girls, right?
Well, right, because it's so much more expected that it would be a bad teacher, but it's so much, it resonates on a different level when it's the collective group doing this to someone. And it's a metaphor for so many situations in life.
It's not as comforting, perhaps. It's mm-hmm. more, I think, you know, it's this bad adult. Who's behaving badly. And it's not the group, it's not we who are responsible.
Right.
And I did have some reactions like that from people. I remember one going to a school, actually, a very distinguished school in New York. And the parents were talking, there was one of the books that they read, and they asked if the author would come in. And I remember one of the mothers saying that no, girls would never act this way. They would not act this way. So what can you say? You know,
right.
You think of, you know, Queen Victoria. Apparently, they asked Queen Victoria, you know, because there were laws for homosexuals, men, you know, having sex together, and they were, you know, imprisoned, like Oscar Wilde, etc. And so somebody asked Queen Victoria, but shouldn't there be some laws for women as well? What if women did this? And Queen Victoria said, "Oh, women would never do that."
Yeah. I mean, people believe what they want to believe, I guess, right? Well, that leads into a question of mine, because you've written both memoir and fiction. And I'm, you know, there's autobiographical material in the fiction, but fiction gives you the comfort of fictionalizing what you what you can't handle, or changing scenes that aren't working, getting to a truth through maybe a fudging of the scene, but it's an emotional truth you're getting to rather than the actual truth. So I'm wondering about what the process is like writing memoir versus fiction for you.
Yes, well, I think fiction is easier, frankly, for me anyway, because just for the reasons that you've given, that you can change things, you can make things so that the structure holds. Whereas with memoir, you still have to structure it because people want a story, right? They want the comfort of a story. They want reversal. They want something withheld that they're going to discover in the reading of the story. So you do have to structure what you're doing, but you also are obliged to stick with the facts. So you have to structure the facts in such a way that they're both true and also that you have this story, you have this steady forward motion, as this writing teacher I had said, steady forward motion. So you've got to have a moment of revelation, perhaps in some way, but it's got to be also true. So the memoir that I wrote, Once We Were Sisters, was about my sister's death. And so I sort of started at the end a little bit as I would do if I were writing that as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Starting, you know, she's dead.
But right.
Why? And that was, of course, a question that I asked myself in reality. And I think when something unbelievable and exceptional happens, you're trying to find out as a writer. That's what propels you into the story. Why did this happen? And of course, you may not ever find the answer, but it gives your piece of fiction or nonfiction, it gives it the structure that you want. So that's what I did ultimately after many, many years of writing that story, the death of my sister. I wrote in fictional form again and again. And
yes.
Tracks was just one form of writing it, actually. And then finally I said, now come on, you can do this. So I wrote what actually happened, but with sufficient structure that the reader was held to just try to discover with me, with the writer, you know, what was it? Was it this society that I was born into, the South African society, racist, this was apartheid? Was it that? Was it this boarding school I went to, you know, with this very strict religion and, you know, turn the other cheek, somebody hits one side, you turn the other. Was it that? Was it just the position of women in those days? What caused my sister's death?
Mm-hmm. So it's like you were circling it and circling it, and then finally you were able to just hone in directly on it.
On the story, although I never really could come up with the answer to that, because obviously these things are always, you know, so many different elements are responsible. And it was, you know, very tragic. She was 38, 39. She had six children.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I did read that with Robin, who you met at. Yeah, you're right.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so sorry about that. And I was thinking when you said that about Cracks, was she in Fiamma, or were you thinking of her?
We both were very privileged in a way in South Africa, the way we were brought up, and not aware perhaps of some of the things that other people might have learned earlier in their lives.
Yes. Right, right. That innocence. It's very scary. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time because you very nicely did this twice. And it was such a thrill to talk to you. And I really, really appreciate your kindness.
No questions and your wonderful interview, really.
Oh, thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed the show. As always, we appreciate donations. They keep us running. You can make a donation at my website, kellyforden.com. See you next month.